right, everyone. It's Thursday, January 9th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. God, it was cold this morning. That's my only weather report for Concord, but it was wicked cold this morning. That's all I have to say. You know, I listened to our opening song, Tall Cool One, and I really think I wish my mother had played that for me when I was about 6 years old, because maybe I really would have liked piano lessons. I just keep thinking about it. I hear it and I'm going, oh God, if I could do that on the ivories, I would be so excited. Music is such an empowerful toxic tool. You know, it's toxic in a negative way. Mm-hmm. It's rehabilitative in a positive way. It says and speaks to us in so many important ways that we can't use words, but they can find the notes. And that's what I so love.
And some songs are just so good, like this one. Time I hear it,
I know.
I just get uplifted and I want to dance.
It's the Fabulous Wailers, 1959, folks, just to let you know.
But, you know, not every song you can keep listening to every day and not get sick of it. But
this one
is fabulous.
Play it for your children. They'll want to take piano lessons. All right. Anyway, so what's floating your boat right now?
A number of immigration issues, Arnie, are floating my boat or sinking my ship, depending on how you want to look at it. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal court just below the Supreme Court that governs the area around the border wall, has reversed a decision below and allowed construction to proceed on the border wall.
Yeah, no, I saw that.
The lower court had issued a temporary injunction. This isn't a ruling on the merits, but still, the temporary injunction had said, no, you can't move funds from one DHS activity into something that wasn't appropriated for. Right. Trump moves it to the border wall. Now the appeals court, the Fifth Circuit, has reversed that and said, yes, you go right ahead. While we're litigating this case, the propriety of doing this, you go ahead and build your wall and use those $3.6 billion of military construction funds to build the wall instead of whatever other things it was appropriated for.
And the timing is so perfect, especially with what's going on with Iran, but we won't.
Yeah.
I just,
and I think
it?
That's pretty bad. And then in another legal case, there was a migrant who won his case, a guy from Venezuela, won his case in immigration court, and the U.S. didn't abide by the ruling and sent him back to Mexico anyway. It's kind of shocking, but it's consistent with Trump's seeming view that the law doesn't apply to me.
And their rationale was what? That the law doesn't apply to me. Is that basically – I mean, I'm just trying to figure out. So you go to court, you win your case, and they send you back anyway? And I'm just trying to figure out, then nothing has meaning. Then nothing.
Yeah. Needless to say, the immigrant certainly didn't understand what the court's reasoning was.
I'll raise my hand. I don't either.
I think that they are just not following the rules, and that's the difference. The Customs and Border Patrol says that it can return migrants to Mexico anytime it wants.
Wow.
Because the immigration judge's decision is going to be appealed, so they can return people pending that appeal, which is a frightening thought, because once you're deported, it's kind of hard to get back in. And then there is another case where you remember when I visited the Homestead Child Detention Center. One of the big things was that it was a private company. It was a for-profit company that was running the jail that was keeping these children who had been separated by their families. Well, now there's a private Texas company that is planning on helping to build a border wall, and there was a lawsuit about it. But the court hasn't ruled yet on whether it's going to let this private company go ahead and build the wall, but it looks like they will.
So, in other words, we're losing.
I'm sorry?
We're losing. I mean, every single thing you've brought up so far is that nothing is successful. You go to court and win, you still lose. You know, I just feel like it's a whack-a-mole. Every time I think that there's an opportunity, they slap it down.
Right. And you know, one of the most heinous things, and if any of you listeners want to talk to your congresspeople or senators about this, I would encourage you to do so. The Senate and Congress approved appropriations for DHS, Homeland Security, and all of its subparts, including ICE and Border Patrol. But it also included a provision that says that Homeland Security can transfer funds from any of its other activities, like FEMA help or any other kind of Homeland Security issues. They can transfer the money down to the border. And now apparently they can go ahead and build a border wall while they're litigating that. That is a provision which senators and congresspeople can appropriate every year. They can enact provisions that say you can use the money we allocate to you, Mr. President, but you can't use money that we allocate towards one thing and transfer it to use it to build your wall. Mm-hmm. And so far, a number of times that amendment has been introduced. A lot of Democrats have voted for the amendment saying you can't cheat.
Right.
And it's passed. Some of our New Hampshire Democrat senators have voted, unfortunately, against the amendment and allowed Trump to transfer the money. We're working on them again to vote against it. But anywhere in the country, your senators and congresspeople have the opportunity to stop Trump from transferring money from one Homeland Security issue to his border wall. And please ask them to do so.
All right. Thank you very much. So before we grab our first guest, because as I pointed out, I needed a dose of Bill Curry. I saw a piece at the Pew Research Center. And I have two daughters. They're in their 30s. And I have to tell you how many times I apologize to them about how challenging their future is. And after spending decades and decades within the political process or in the media trying to educate people about the issues and the challenges of the day, I feel like every time I turn around, it's getting worse and worse and worse. And I am so discouraged. And then I saw this study. Looking to the future, public sees an America in decline on many fronts. Majorities predict a weaker economy, a growing income divide, a degraded environment, and a broken political system. I'm trying to figure out, is there anything left? It's just incredible. And this is, in a way, I think this is the Donald Trump legacy, is that you know, I think there was a bit of hope. And there really was hope that was delivered by Barack Obama. He didn't necessarily live up to that hope after his 8 years. But I didn't think that there was this sort of negative sense about where we are as a nation and where we were going. We knew we had challenges, but I think there was a sense that we could maybe overcome the challenges. But again, I want to read this headline from the Pew Research Center. Looking to the future, public sees an America in decline on many fronts. They predict a weaker economy, a growing income divide, a degraded environment, and a broken political system. Boy, I tell you, that doesn't make me a happy camper. All right. Joining us right now on the line is Bill Curry. As I said, that in a time of confusion, chaos, and crisis, we turn to Curry. So, Bill, you got alliteration and you got an invitation. You
well,
got both.
And here I was calling you for consolation.
So, you know, I was thinking about what happened this week with, obviously the president's press conference, what happened with Iran, what happened with Soleimani, and thinking about how, once again, what is going to test the 2020 candidates is how they are going to be able to respond to the changing environment around them. And obviously, foreign policy is now going to be front and center in the next Des Moines CNN debate happening in Iowa next week. So as someone who's paid a lot of attention to foreign policy over the years, I would love to get a sense from you, basically, how do you think these candidates are going to respond, and how do we evaluate their response?
I'm sorry, how do I think the candidates will respond?
Yeah. And because, again, there is going to be a divide. I mean, I think I already kind of know it, the Biden-Buttigieg divide, the Sanders-Warren divide.
I got a New Yorker piece from you, which I had actually in email before the show, and that made the point that there were differences within the field. I find the differences of expressed view subtler than that so far. I mean, all of them are expressing various forms of opposition, most of it pretty strong. It is absolutely true that Bernie and Bernie first, followed by Warren second, are criticizing the actions taken most in the context of a thoroughgoing anti-war perspective, and that there are differences there to sort of explore among those candidates. And I would just say this, though. This is like, if I can just step back a second, something I've said here a number of times and I've been writing about, and that is that here's a Democratic Party which is in agreement on so many things in ways that it never historically. This was a party, this is the New Deal and the Great Society, was divided between Southern segregationists and mostly Northern liberals, and yet produced those the New Deal and the Great Society. America's divided by age, by race, by gender, by location, urban versus rural, but not the Democratic Party. You break down almost all of its groups, and there's unanimity. There is on some other issues, on so many issues like gun safety and climate change and corruption and most of healthcare. There's just enormous popular support for the things we want to do. And what the Democratic Party needs to do is to define its own policies more clearly, to get bipartisan with itself, work its differences out, and put this majoritarian consensus on the table. Because we're not only in agreement with ourselves, but we've never, since the invention of polling, been closer to the sentiments of the majority of Americans. The party's never been more at peace with itself on its biggest issues, right, and closer to the sentiments of Americans. And there are, however, some areas where that consensus has not been developed because of our own timidity. In foreign policy and national security is where I would say there is a latent consensus. On this, as in so many issues previously in the last 25 years, the public has moved a long way. And it requires only the leadership to point out the things we've learned and to build clear policies around them. What have we learned in 20 years in the Middle East? We've learned that these vast armies that we finance are of almost no use in the cardinal mission of keeping us safe.
Exactly, exactly.
We've learned that all this money we're spending does very, very little to make us safe in a world of asymmetrical opponents and cyber warfare and terrorist bombings. We're still spending so much money on a military that is no longer functional. We've spent as much money as you can in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it hasn't settled a thing. Helping America absorb that lesson. Number two, it is impossible to export democracy by force of arms. Yeah. Again, as soon as you say it to almost any audience, heads start nodding. And number three, that America has exported far more corruption than democracy. We export corruption in the name of democracy. We did it in Russia and helped create an atmosphere which led to the creation of the biggest mafia, the Russian, the biggest mobster economy in history. We've done it in Iraq. We've made the Iraq government a pariah to all of its own people, Shiite, Muslim, and Sunni alike, pardon me, because the government is in such disrepute because we've handed them billions and billions of dollars in cash without ever a real accounting, just to bribe people. And that's what they've learned from it, corruption. And it's one of the things that keeps things from being ever solved. Here at home, there ought to be a rule, by the way, I don't have this quite finished, but we ought to require our government to observe the same practices that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act requires of corporations. Our government should be at least as ethical as our global corporations. We should hold ourselves to at least that highest standard in forbidding the corruption of local officials and local political factions. We have learned from our own dispute with Russia over the 2016 election that we should stop our own interference in the domestic politics of other countries.
Right.
It's bought us nothing. And most important, in watching these last few days, the breaking hearts for me, it's time to take American foreign and national security policy public. Whatever they do in the dark ends up redounding, as if by a karmic law, to our great, great detriment, often to our great shame, when we lie our way into wars, as we did with the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, this goes back to the Maine, when the battleship Maine was sunk in Havana Harbor. One of the questions that should have been asked at the time, or at any point since, is, by the way, what was that battleship doing in Havana? what was going on there anyway? And secondly, why was there never a real, the very first reports to President McKinley all of the first reports were that it was an accident that began in the coal bunkers. And Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst turned it into a terrorist explosion and a pretext for a war for empire. And we, you know, in the Gulf of Tonkin and weapons of mass destruction, and now along comes this debacle, in my view, which on its face, this was not an attempt to avenge ourselves for the killing of a single contractor or to forestall an imminent a military threat against Americans. Those are both lies. It's as lies as big as weapons of mass destruction, as big as the Gulf of Tonkin, as big as Remember the Maine.
Yeah.
It's just not true. On its face, it makes no sense. When you have people in the Iraq War, it was Paul Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld and a set of neocons, Bill Kristol, whom I respect for, but more than I do those guys, but who was nonetheless one of those culprits in all of that. They'd wanted to export democracy by the force of arms in the Middle East for a long time. And the weapons of mass destruction was something that the people on the inside made up. Dick Cheney had to set up his own intelligence operation to supersede the CIA, put it in Rumsfeld's Defense Department, so that they could manufacture false intelligence data in order to justify what they were doing. It was just a lie, and it had been in the works for a long time. We know this, but we don't know it because we never studied it. One of the greatest mistakes the Obama administration was made in the very first months when he said it would be too difficult for the country to look back. England, Gordon Brown succeeded Tony Blair, who was a member of Tony Blair's party, commissioned the Chilcot Report, which was a devastating expose of the lies and manipulations that had gone on in England just to get them to follow us into the Iraq War. And over there, even Boris Johnson doesn't want to be identified with what's going on in between the U.S. and Iran, because over there the public learned what they'd done in the dark was brought into the light. And they know those kinds of people can no longer, it's no longer at least as easy for them to pull those kinds of shenanigans. And so when you watch what's happened here, all the obvious lying, Pompeo and Bolton are in the Wolfowitz role. They've wanted a military aggression against Iran for as long as they can remember. Mm-hmm. And this was a part of what we watched in the last few days was the supreme leader of Iran not taking the bait. They know they can't have they have proxy wars because they can't have full-on war with the United States because they'd lose because we're bigger and have all the money and more weapons, and it would be impossible. Not that they're such great people, far from it, but they're not going to do that. And so we're not going to have a war. We weren't going to have a war before this happened. We're not going to have an all-out war between two nation states now. But we are going to have continued violence in this country, and so in that region. And we're going to be responsible ourselves for a lot of it. And none of it's going to make us safer. None of it's going to propagate democracy. None of it's going to bring peace. And so when I look at the debate now coming up, I would just say all the things I've just said were things that were much harder to say in America 20 years ago.
Right,
but the public's been moving forward.
Right.
It's time for all of the Democrats who, again, Bernie's been doing it for a long time, although even no Democrats talk about foreign policy or national security as much as they ought to. We were all taught coming up that it was the third rail, don't touch it. When it comes up, say as little as you can and change the topic as quickly as possible. And, as with climate change, as with so many, as with Obama telling his cabinet in his first term not to talk too much about climate change, people weren't ready for it. Underestimating how ready people were to hear the truth.
So
here we are. This is a great opportunity to make all those points, to put that into a coherent policy and make it the platform of the Democratic Party. The public is ready.
So can someone say this on the debate stage and quote Obama? We don't look backwards, we look forward. And say no. Because if we don't look backwards, our forwards is a repetition of the same mistakes because we don't comprehend the choices we have. And in a lot of ways, I mean, almost liberating people to have a conversation. As soon as I saw this, I thought, okay, here's the whole conversation. You voted for the Iraq war. I didn't vote for the Iraq war. And that'll be the end of looking backwards. That will be the end of looking backwards. But in a lot of ways, what you just did, a much more full-throated sort of response, I would love to see someone say that on the debate stage and say the mistake we made was by not doing the analysis, by not understanding the mistakes, by not comprehending what we needed to do. Therefore, moving forward was not going to be possible. And in a lot of ways, it almost opens it up to be more nuanced than just voting for the Iraq war or not voting for the Iraq war, because that's all you're going to hear next Tuesday.
Right. That's right. I think that's such an important point. And because here's the other thing, okay? I've been working on these issues all my life. I was the political director of the nuclear freeze movement back in the 1980s. And this is stuff that I've worked in some of these issues in different parts of the world. I'm a great believer in that we keep front and center the ultimate goal, which is the renunciation of violence and the resolution of human conflict. I also know that we're not there yet, and that without a doubt, the first job of a government is to keep its people safe.
Exactly.
Okay? No question about it. And the first point here is that none of this makes us safe. People can feel it. And what it does is foster more more conflict and more death. And we have to be ready, number one, as I said, to make that policy. Number two, to speak freely about who we have been as a country. And America's done much good in the world. But the origins of our dispute with Iran are a CIA coup in which we knocked off a democratically elected president in 1954, I think, in the 1950s, and replaced him with a vicious dictator.
Exactly.
And if that had happened, if the Iranians had knocked off Ike, we wouldn't have gotten over it yet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
We don't know our own history. We don't know. Some of this is just, we have to do a better job of teaching both history and civics. But, what are the most important foreign policy reforms the Democrats can run on right now? One, bring all this stuff into the open.
Yes.
Take American foreign policy public.
Yes.
Extend FOI to vastly in areas of national security and foreign policy. Get the documents public, get the history public, and demand that the current decision-making process, the alleged briefing, the alleged after the fact briefing
that was
in the Senate yesterday was an affront to the Constitution.
Well, and I just want to remind you, I think you begin the conversation about foreign policy to remind everyone what you just said, that the whole raison d'etre for foreign policy is to keep us safe. Right?
Yep.
And start with that and then go down the litany of how less safe we are. So these are not only not transparent, they probably are driven by corruption, but they're making us less safe. So the trifecta of failure is now what we see. And if you start with the idea, my job is to keep you safe, and this is why this has not done it, really puts the Republicans back on their heels.
And if I may, Bill, add one thing, and that is in terms of how it's communicated. I agree completely with your splendidly articulate layout, but how the Democrats communicate it. Arnie was talking about having people on the Democratic debate stage talk right about it, but the communication strategy really is key because it has to be. There has to be no way for the media or the public to be to let it be distorted into a hate America policy.
Exactly.
And these are our mistakes,
exactly,
and our country really screwed up here. It has to be more come from a love America viewpoint, and it's because we love America and we believe in what our country could stand for, and that's why we want to make these changes.
Bill?
Although, let me just say one thing, Ken. I agree with everything you just said, but I would also just say I've said this a million times, policy precedes message. First, figure out what you believe and then how to tell people about it.
Right.
And if we just take the right positions, It's amazing how, you know, a powerful idea will do your organizing messaging for you.
Yes.
It'll even do a lot of your fundraising.
You're right.
And so we, what we haven't done is believed enough in the power of just taking the right positions here. And we haven't trusted the American people enough. One of the prices we pay for Trump is that his presidency has made us think less of one another, has made us less trusting of our own democracy.
Right, exactly.
I'll confess myself, I didn't believe we were a country that could elect such a transparently fascist
corrupt
charlatan.
Yeah.
And it's happened, and it shakes our faith, but you can't lose. You can't if you can't just blame it all on the voters. You know, it's not, you know,
yeah,
the people on our side, many people on our side have drawn too dark a view of the American people. And one of the things that makes you do is makes you less willing to put the best arguments on the table because you're afraid of them.
And
so worried about messaging that you don't just simply come out and say, no more secrets. The big armies aren't working.
Exactly.
No more corruption,
etc. Exactly. Now you understand why I began this way. In a time of confusion, chaos, and crisis, we turn to Curry. Bill Curry, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate this.
I hope I can run it past
all the 2020 candidates as they approach Tuesday's debate. Thank you again.
Thanks,
ciao.
Bill. Take care.
Right, take care, guys.
All right. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. Do national security concerns outweigh the right of workers to form a union? That question was being debated on this day in labor history. The year was 2003. The head of the Transportation Security Administration, James Loy, made the case that collective bargaining would be an impediment to the war on terrorism. He signed an order that prohibited unionization by passenger and baggage screeners. The move was just one of several that eroded federal workers' rights in the name of national security in the aftermath of 9/11. The TSA was founded in the months after the 9/11 attacks by the Bush administration. Prior to the TSA, screening was done by private contractors run by the airlines. With the new organization, more than 45,000 screeners became part of the federal workforce. Massachusetts Senator Teddy Kennedy disagreed with the Bush administration's position that these workers could not join a union. He released a statement saying, "It's not Homeland Security, it's union busting." The TSA workers did not give up their fight to join a union. For the better part of a decade, they continued to organize and make their case. In 2011, the workers voted to become part of the American Federation of Government Employees. It was the largest union election by federal workers in United States history. There are limitations to the union, however, such as the screeners cannot go on strike, but the union can advocate for safe and fair workplace conditions. When the union was finally recognized, president of AFGE John Gage issued a statement. He declared, "Today marks the recognition of a fundamental human right for 40,000 patriotic federal employees who have been disenfranchised since the inception of the agency. Today, nearly 16,000 screeners have joined the union." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. You may enjoy gazing out the window and seeing familiar birds, like goldfinches, robins, or warblers, flitting between tree branches. But as the climate warms, many bird species will need to leave some of the places they've long considered home.
These areas just become no longer suitable, and they'll have to move to new areas.
Brooke Bateman is a senior scientist at the National Audubon Society. She says for bird lovers who want to visualize what this means in their own yards, Audubon created an online tool. Users can enter a zip code and learn more about local climate threats and the risks they pose to birds.
It really gives you a local snapshot of what's happening with climate change.
The tool highlights which species will no longer find suitable local habitat by the end of the century. Users can toggle between different levels of future warming so they can see that without climate action,
oh, these birds that come to my feeder or these birds I see in my backyard, they're not going to be there anymore.
But if carbon pollution is sharply reduced, the risk to many species are too. The tool shows how climate action can help your favorite birds return to your feeder year after year. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Well, it's so hot to face that in this day and age, somebody's race can trigger somebody's rage. Somebody's preference can drive some total stranger. Make somebody somehow feel the wrath of their anger. Why don't we put it on forward and show? Show her and put it to hell. Be racist, be sexist, be bigots, be sure. We won't stand for your hate. No ice to cut and dry. A simple concept is give tolerance a try. And this confusion still exists. Ignorant mongers, no areas gray. Couldn't be any wronger in this age of day. Why don't we put in one order and show? Show her and put it to hell. Be racist, be sexist, be bigots, be sure. We won't stand for your hate. Get that straight.
Ah, I was waiting for that line. We won't stand for your hate. Sometimes these things are hard to follow. You know, it's like, what were those words? Yes. What were those words? Why did you pick this song? This is The Attitude with Artie Artist and producer Ken Barnes. Pixar Music. Tell them the title of the song, who sings it. And it was finally when I heard We Won't Stand for Your Hate.
I'm like, let's face it, we won't stand for your hate. And yeah, sometimes it is hard to tell why Ken picks those songs. It's sung by the Mighty Boss Tones.
Ah, the Mighty Boss Tones. Well, from Iowa is the mighty Stefan Schmidt, yeah. Affectionately known as Dr. Politics. Stefan Schmidt teaches political science at Iowa State. Next week, all eyes will be on Iowa because the last debate before the Iowa caucus will be taking place with a small number of candidates on the debate stage. So I saw an article, Stefan, and I kind of loved it. It was by Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone. Campaign Diary, Notes from the Most Unpredictable Primary Race Ever. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, everything is unpredictable. I wish it was just the primary race he's talking about. So as we begin to sort of wait for the conclusions of whatever we're going to get from the Iowa caucus, tell me about what you are seeing. Are anyone but the top four sort of really emerging? You know, is Cory Booker going to be able to sort of reorganize? Is Amy going to be able to punch through and say, remember, I'm that Minnesota girl. I'm a Midwest person, too, just like you, Iowa. I'm just trying to figure out how they're going to be addressing this, especially because of what just happened with Iran.
Yeah, that's, Arnie, that's, if I knew the answer to the question, I would be probably retired by now on an island somewhere, because it is really a very diverse and complex year. Cory Booker is still very much alive. He has family in Iowa. He just went to the home of his aunt, and there were pictures of some relatives that they gave to him. It was a very emotional thing, and his connection to Iowa is pretty much unknown, you know. So he's trying very hard to remain relevant. His ads are very good. He has a terrific ad about bringing unity and bringing us all together, and kind of, unfortunately, that's sort of the story that all of them are trying to spin, Joe Biden and others.
And none of them as well as Cory, though.
Pardon me?
None of them are telling that unity story as well as Cory.
Well, yeah. I mean, because he's black, you know, but then...
Much more than because he's black. I think he's one of the most...
Because he's authentic.
Yeah, he's very... I mean, he's not necessarily my candidate, but every time I hear him, I mean, I don't need to look at him. I just need to hear him. Yeah. And he has both an authentic message, and he is a message of hope. In a lot of ways, he sort of continued to follow on with Barack Obama. You feel inspired after you hear him speak.
You do, and I can tell you, because I'm in Iowa and because I see and hear not only their political ads, which now have become avalanches. I mean, literally, there are no automobile ads, no cereal ads, no insurance ads, nothing except commercials by all the candidates. They obviously bulked up for the final push. Amy Klobuchar has a very, very good ad in which she says, you know, we're not flyover country. This is my home, and this is what I've done. Her ad is very good. Joe Biden has a really terrific ad as well, in which he says, you know, I've got a lot of experience, and this is not a moment for inexperience. Mayor Pete has a nice, nice ad where he says, you know, I go around Iowa and I see the communities, and it's sad that what's happening here happened in my hometown. The good jobs went abroad, and people are now working and making half of what they made. So when you say authentic, I think, you know, what's authentic to you, someone else may be authentic to a bunch of other people. So there is no universal criterion for authenticity. And I think the top four, I mean, Elizabeth Warren has a great, great initiative here, spending a lot of money, and more people, as they see her in some of these events and her ads, are saying, you know, I actually do respect her and I like her, which was not the case a few months ago with some people that I know. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think that probably four people will do well in Iowa, and as my good friend, and I won't mention her name, she's retired now, great, great academic, said, but the top two are two old white guys,
yeah.
And that would be Bernie Sanders, of course, and Joe Biden. Buttigieg is right up there with them. There's a three-way tie in the latest Iowa polls. Elizabeth Warren is next. Klobuchar next, and, you know, unfortunately, Booker is not anywhere up there. So,
No, I know.
Yeah, the Democrats are going to have to make a decision, not just in Iowa, but then a week later, we all go to New Hampshire, and you guys have a chance to say, nah, we don't like these top three that came out of Iowa. We think so-and-so is better. And then, of course, South Carolina and Nevada. And after that, it's craziness because it's Super Tuesday and it's all those massive, huge states.
I'm kind of curious. Is Michael Bloomberg running any ads? I know he's not
running.
No, he's not. Here's the thing. I know he's not running in Iowa.
No ads. I haven't seen any ads.
And I am surprised a little bit because he's kind of running as if he's already the nominee, because many of his ads are kind of the themes of the Democratic Party. We were just talking to Bill Curry.
Yeah.
Bill Curry basically said something that, like, 80% of what the Democrats are saying is they all think it. There is more that holds us together, and it actually, in a way, represents most of where the middle of America is. And if you listen to Bloomberg's ads, I always find them absolutely fascinating. My favorite part of his ads, if you get sick, you go to a doctor.
Yeah.
And if you get sick, you get your medicine. I'm thinking, wow, that's healthcare policy for you. You know,
And I was doing research, as you know, and I was in Georgia and in South Carolina and North Carolina and Florida and Virginia. And Bloomberg is running massive ads there, but not here. But what you said earlier, actually, if you'd pardon me for correcting you, what you said that, you know, all of us Democrats agree on the same thing, that's not at all true. AOS.
AOC.
I'm sorry. I'm tired. I've been traveling.
Yeah.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has just said, these people that are running, except for Bernie Sanders, they don't even belong in the Democratic Party. Really? An extraordinary hacking of the axe, you know, cleaving the party. She is a socialist, a democratic socialist, and is saying that these people, these moderates, don't belong in the party. Well, that doesn't tell me that the party is very unified.
Well, I think I told you this already, but that what I basically said was that AOC should take a look at Bernie's record. Because if you look at Bernie's record, it's a record of working across the aisle.
It is.
And I mean both the Democratic aisle as well as the Republican aisle. It's about voting for things that necessarily aren't exactly what you wanted, but are moving in the right direction to what you want. So it is, to me, so fascinating because in a lot of ways, I admire her. She's incredibly bright. But she, in a lot of ways, is incredibly naive. Because when you sit on the outside of the political process and you look in, you think, okay, there's a level of quote-unquote purity, which is the word that they use today.
Yep.
And I will be honest with you, there's a bit of me that was like that. I'll give you an example. In New Hampshire, we were the last state to embrace Martin Luther King's birthday. Okay? Just before I left the legislature, we voted for a bill that would not recognize MLK, but would recognize Civil Rights Day. I voted against it because it wasn't MLK. It was civil rights. And I go back now and I think, was I right or was I wrong? Was I being too much of a purist saying that civil rights was the royal punt? Because it was a way to sort of, you know, cover the proverbial, you know what, rear end of a lot of Republicans who did not want to do anything that would use the term Martin Luther King. Or was it a way of a stepping stone to get us there? You know, yep. So there are times I look back at myself and say, when am I making a stand? Or when am I realizing that this kind of compromise is really going to be, in the long run, moving us in the right direction?
No, Arnie, you're absolutely right. But what you do is you rally around the best that you can, your party, even though you don't like some of the things that the candidate who is going to win, whether it's for the state legislature, right, for House or Senate, or for president, right, is presenting. And then you bring up the differences and try to convince others to do things a little differently. You don't do that before you've won an election,
exactly,
because it drives people away. It gives people a signal. I know a lot of people who like Bernie Sanders and like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And by having said that, they're going to do the same that the Sanders supporters did when he didn't get the nomination last time, I'm afraid, for you guys, for you Democrats. And that is, they're going to say, well, I'm going to stay home. Or they're going to say, well, screw you, I can't use the right language here. And they'll vote for Trump again.
Well, let me just say something. The one thing that you heard me say this before, I'm going to say it again. So I asked Bernie which party in 2015 when, yep, he was running, because he's always run as an independent. And at that point in time, he said he would embrace the Democratic Party. No sooner does he lose the primary than guess what he does? He goes, I'm taking my ball home and I'm leaving the Democratic primary. Then he decides to run again. He goes, oh, I think I'm going to be a Democrat again. Well, I'm thinking, what do you think this is, a smorgasbord? You know, you get to, oh, I'll pick it this week. No, next week I'll pick this food. And part of the problem with what AOC said vis-a-vis Bernie is that I want my party to be better. I want it to be more transparent. I want it to really speak to the issues of where I think the base is, speak to the issues of inequality. If you are going to drop in or drop out or say that you are really not part of this Democratic Party, then you haven't done the necessary heavy lifting of repairing the Democratic Party. It needs to be repaired. It doesn't need to be kicked in the groin.
Can I just say, following up on that, I agree completely that it needs to be repaired and it doesn't need to be kicked in the groin. But separate and apart from what AOC said last week, before she said it, wouldn't you agree that the primaries are where the party defines who it is and what it stands for, or right, at least what it's going to stand for in 2020? And that's why the different candidates are recommending the policies that they're recommending, and they're recommending different policies, different ways of looking at the world and the country. And that's what they should be doing in a primary. And the voters within the Democratic Party will choose who we want our standard bearer, what we want our standard to be for this election to run against,
yeah,
Trump.
No, I see that. I agree with you. But there's a line that's, I think, for the Democrats, very dangerous, which is to say it's, you know, all or nothing. And I'm seeing a lot of that among supporters, people who are going to go on caucus night, who are very, very, call it passionate on the extremes. For Democrats, that may mean that they either won't vote or vote for somebody else. I even heard somebody said they might vote for a moderate Republican or
they don't exist.
Who, wait, there's somebody running as an independent now?
Oh, yes, from Rhode Island.
Right.
He's running as a libertarian, not as an independent.
Okay, libertarian.
So
yeah,
Chafee's running as a. But let me just say something. It's on both sides. So someone I adore, a former long-term AP reporter, has said that if Bernie Sanders got the nomination, she would not support him. So we keep thinking that it's only one way or the other. And I'm just going to tell you, I'm going to give them both a knuckle sandwich. Because in the end, that is not going to be useful for moving forward. That in the end, the regrets you will have if Donald Trump gets reelected are so enormous. Because the consequences, let's be honest here, this is not about us. He has lit a match to the world. This is destabilizing the world. Our European allies don't even understand what the hell is going on. We're looking at Putin now being the person who's trying to figure out how to stabilize the situation. Well, that'll make me feel good. I mean, look what he has done. So in a lot of ways, the burden on us in 2000 is not, in 2020, is not just about what we like, but looking at the chaos he has created for the planet and realizing that we have something more important than us, and that is who we are as planet Earth, because he is so frickin' destructive. I'm sorry.
You know, there's trouble. The force has been disturbed, but the world has not been very safe for a long time, and so this is just an exaggerated disruption, which is why Donald Trump was elected, by the way.
Yes.
As you know, the analysis of the exit polls of the 2016 election show that people who wanted a shakeup of the system, who wanted something different, were tired, didn't like regular politicians, people with political backgrounds, voted for Donald Trump. The vast majority of people who said, you know, that's what they wanted. So whether he's shaking it up too much, yeah, we'll have to see in November.
So what's going to happen with impeachment? Because it's so, for me, here's what's fascinating. If Nancy Pelosi sits on the articles of impeachment till Wednesday of next week, the U.S. senators who are running for president will be very happy. If, however, she is forced to actually send the articles of impeachment over before Wednesday, guess what Mitch McConnell will do? He'll order that the hearing begins immediately, and then all those candidates who are running for president who happen to also be U.S. senators can't go to their last debate in Iowa. I think one of the reasons why Nancy Pelosi is now sitting on the articles of impeachment is that she's trying to hold on to them to at least give this last debate schedule in Iowa an opportunity to happen, because trust me, there'll be no conversation. There'll be nothing happening because those people will be stuck in Washington. This hurts the caucus more than anything else.
Yeah. On the other hand, as you know, my rating for debates, especially the, what is it now, the 34th debate, maybe,
yeah,
33 debates. I'm just kidding, but
I know.
It's been endless. People just don't pay that much attention anymore to those debates. You know, they've met in Iowa, they've met every candidate. The people who are going to the caucuses, which is the Democratic caucuses, 10% of eligible Democrats will go to those caucuses. They are politically pretty motivated. They are very well informed. They know the position of every candidate. They're not interested in oops moments and glitches and stuff like that. So if the, you know, Senate begins to do the impeachment trial and some of these senators have to stay in D.C., it's not going to really hurt. I mean, Elizabeth Warren isn't going to lose any supporters because she's not still on the campaign trail shaking people's hands.
But let me just stop you there.
I think that Nancy Pelosi may have another strategy, which I would find much more interesting and much more satisfying if you're a Democrat. And that is to say, we should not do something this big before the next election. We should hold the trial of Donald Trump, who has been impeached, after the 2020 election.
Why?
Because if you can't nominate a Supreme Court justice to the Senate for confirmation, you know, before the next presidential election, then you can't hold the impeachment trials before the next election either.
Well, I mean, let me just say something. The reason why this last debate in Des Moines may be important is because of foreign policy. And Donald Trump right now is going to be able to control the foreign policy conversation. I know that the senator from Utah is apoplectic about the fact that it was the most dissatisfying information he ever received from the Defense Department. But as I'm saying this, because everyone is paying attention to this issue, and this is the one issue where we've not really had a full-throated discussion about this kind of policy, and everyone is thinking about that. 55%.
Good. I give you credit for that.
Okay,
you may be right. It may be that the viewership for the Des Moines Register debate will be huge, and Wolf Blitzer whom I don't care for that much. She's too theatrical, will do a great job. And that's fine. That's great. Right now, of course, you know that really Joe Biden has, you know, the field advantage there on that, because he's been vice president for 8 years and, you know, has a lot of foreign policy experience.
Well, but some of it doesn't not that so make good, him partly but, responsible for where everything is in Syria and with ISIS and the Middle East altogether?
It was actually Jimmy Carter who you should be blaming, because Jimmy Carter abandoned the Middle East and allowed the Iranians to basically dominate with the hostages, didn't get reelected after that.
Reagan made it all good, right?
And,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, Jimmy Carter thought that the Ayatollahs would be okay. They were all living in exile in Paris. But he thought, we can create a kind of moderate regime in Iran. He obviously didn't know any Iranians who have a very strong view, and he didn't know much about what would happen. So if you want to blame someone, don't blame Biden. Go blame Jimmy Carter.
So let me
hostages were still being held the day Carter left office. It was Reagan who took over dealing
with
Iran.
Right. And Jimmy Carter did not strike back and did not, you know, he told the military and his team, well, okay, we'll try to rescue them, but, you know, we don't want too big a footprint, so let's cut the number of helicopters and commandos that go in half. And then they had that disaster in the desert because a couple of planes crashed into each other, or helicopters before they could launch. You know, come on. I mean, Jimmy Carter was a true believer in human rights, and he thought if you're just nice to people, that's good. I like Jimmy Carter. You know, he's the greatest
ex-president. I knew you were going to say that. All right, so let me just say why I think the Des Moines debate is going to be important.
Okay.
A new poll just came out. 55% of Americans say killing of Soleimani makes U.S. less safe. Now, that poll says that there is an opportunity to have a foreign policy conversation that actually hurts Donald Trump, that it's an opportunity to really sort of support the frustration that you saw coming from Mike Lee from Utah, that this was not about an urgency that needed to be responded to by taking out Soleimani. So I think in a lot of ways, people are paying attention. And frankly, the Democrats don't have an opportunity to sort of get everybody's eyeballs on them the way Donald Trump does. Nobody's going to be watching 24/7 MSNBC or CNN or hearing someone speak. This is the time for them to actually have some kind of maybe either unified message or articulate message about the fact that our foreign policy under Donald Trump is making us less safe. And that is not the raison d'etre for foreign policy.
I like it. I like that. I like that more positive view of the value of debates, and I concede to you, you win this argument.
Well, it concede to me that I win. So as we're moving forward, though, Stefan, what I'm also trying to figure out is whether, you know, the idea of Donald Trump losing. You sent me this terrifying article from the Washington Post, which, by the way, I did post on my Facebook page. And they were looking at the state of Virginia. And they were looking at Virginia because Virginia has gone blue, okay? And going blue means that it can now do a lot of the things that it's wanted to do. It can look at issues like gun control. It can look at the issues like climate. It can look at a lot of issues. But obviously, the gun issue is the most provocative issue. Can you remind my audience a little bit about what was described by Paul Waldman in the Washington Post piece? Because it was chilling to see how these people were responding to something they did not like. They don't want these kinds of changes, and therefore, not only are they going to be upset about it, but they may be doing threatening things.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the one, there are two scenarios. We discussed them at the, I was on this wonderful panel, which I didn't deserve to be on because the other political scientists are much better than I am, but it was about the Iowa caucuses, and, and when we talked about the election of 2020, there were two scenarios. One was this one that was actually raised at the panel, which was if Donald Trump loses the election, the extreme supporters of Trump, the militias and very conservative groups and elements, and maybe even most members or many members of the National Rifle Association are going to declare it an illegal election, that there was fraud committed, that's why he lost. And they have been often protesting with firearms strapped around them and sort of posturing in a very threatening way, and that they will do that and maybe go even further. The second scenario that was brought up at our debate, and I don't remember if David Yepsen, the fabulous analyst who is one of the world's greatest political reporters, he's from Iowa, said the other danger is that if Donald Trump wins the election, that the left, extreme left, the Antifa groups and others will say the election was stolen, and that they will begin essentially to do what the democracy protesters did in Hong Kong, in this case, protesting the victory of Donald Trump.
So, you
and
know
they
the moral
will
to the story?
Begin to riot in cities. There will be looting.
All
there
right.
will be all kinds of chaos and anarchy. And so the gloom scenario, if your listeners are interested and want to be depressed, either the victory by Trump or a loss by Trump may very well result in a lot of violence.
All right, so let me
my own view is
yes?
that the conservatives who are armed, because the Antifa people and the left, they protest usually with signs, and they may break some windows and stuff, but they don't carry firearms with them.
Right.
If they use those firearms in any way, the National Guard, the police, the local police, the sheriff department, ATF, and the FBI will stop it.
And I need to let you go, but I'm just going to remind everyone the best antidote to any of this, a huge romp in 2020 for either side. Nobody wins by 1 or 2 points. That's all I have to say. Stefan Schmidt, thank you so much for joining us. Stefan Schmidt is known as Dr. Politics at Iowa State. If it's Thursday, it's Stefan. Ciao, Stefan.
Bye.
And we end with?
We end with Ticking Bomb by Aloe Black.
Here we go.
Sitting on a ticking bomb, the whole world sitting on a ticking bomb. So keep your calm, carry on. The whole world sitting on a ticking bomb. The sun may never rise.